Blog Talk Radio. Your host, Merle Exit. Yeah, it's like 7 p.m. in New York City here, and it's like, wow, what a change in temperature. Well, it's like, what, 60-ish degrees at now? Boy, I'll tell you, far from the rain, the snow. I hope this will last a little while, boy, I'll tell you. But, we got some show. I got a show today. I went off to Orange County, New York, as opposed to Orange County, California. Orange County has a lot up there. It's near Dutchess County, and it's all around the Hudson Valley area. And so while I was there, I did a whirlwind tour in like 3 days. A lot of like the places that even weren't opened yet. VIP, I got a VIP. So I got to get in some places and check them out, places being renovated. We got all these people on the air today. And not only that, I'm also, oh, yes, guess who's here? Guess who's here with me? Oh, yes. And I have, yes. That was Esther just saying hello. And what else did you want to say? Is something else that you wanted to say? Okay, Esther said, well, she's trying to read from this. She said we just returned from Orange County in New York. Okay, Brotherhood Winery has changed for the best to include wines from Chile. Really? Look at that, wines from Chile. Brotherhood Winery, I don't know. That's really old, that place here. Yeah, and what about it? Oh, she says, Caesar. He'll tell us all while I, oh, yes, that's right, while I sip some of the wines. I have a couple of the wines, some of the wines in front of me. Yeah. Then we also have, yes. Okay, she said Bear Mountain Inn is being renovated, and Michael will call in and tell us all about that. And then we also visited, I'm going to say the rest. I hope you don't mind. Please, you know. It's my show. It's my show. Ruth from the Gomez Mill House, she's going to give us a history lesson, and I won't tell you what it is. She'll tell you what it is. And last but not least, Harness Racing Museum. Yes, Gail is going to tour us at the Harness Racing Museum. All of these places are in Orange County, and there's more, but this is just what's up for today. And so got a break for my favorite.
What would you do to earn brownie points? How about treating someone to what may be the best brownies they've ever tasted? Fairy Tale Brownies. They may seem like one of the richest bars of fudge, with varieties that include caramel, chocolate chip, espresso nib, raspberry swirl, mint chocolate, all made with Calbo dark Belgian chocolate. But yes, they are brownies. And that's snow fairy tale.
Yeah, and you can get these on brownies.com. Oh, boy, chocolate, yeah. What's doing? I think, well, let's see. They probably have some sales because, we missed St. Patty's Day, but I think, take a look. Something might be coming up for Easter. I don't think they don't do anything for Passover. It's a whole big thing to do Passover. It's not just, even though chocolates, let's say, are kosher for Passover, it doesn't mean they can do that. It's a whole rigmarole. You have to get the rabbi in there to watch the whole thing being done, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. But if you do really want chocolates for Passover, check it out, a Fifth Avenue Chocolatier. Just Google it, Fifth Avenue Chocolatier, and you'll be able to do that. In the meantime, we're ready to begin our show here, and I think I got Cesar on, don't I?
Yes. How are you, Vinny?
Oh, just fine.
Yeah.
Now, before I do this, I have some of the wines in front of me. And before I do the tasting, let's begin with, tell everybody about, you know, like, not the whole history of Brotherhood Winery, but, you know, the basic stuff.
Yes. Well, Brotherhood is America's oldest winery. It started 1839, continuous operation. We were making wine before California was part of the United States. So that gives you an idea how old we are. And probably before anybody listening, we are older than anybody listening. That's for sure.
Probably, yeah.
Probably. I don't know if somebody older than 160 years old, huh?
I don't think so.
But that give you a story. We are also, the winery was... went through prohibition making altar wine for the church, and that helped keep us in business. So not only we are the oldest, but we are also the continuous operating winery. So that that comes with the we have many products that we've been making for so many years, and that we also now try to bring some. The new wines, including all the premium varietal wines, which is includes Chardonnay, Riesling, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Great Pinot Noir, which is one of my signature wine, and the Riesling obviously has been a very good seller for us with the blue bottle. So we are really doing very nice with that wine. But the winery is also famous for the tours. We have been the first winery we start with tour. That's a tourist attraction. In the 60s, the people used to come here invited for parties, and they had thousands of people came here, and they were enjoy. Taking the tour to the cellars and then end up in a big dancing party.
Now, to kind of like, let's do a, if you can like describe, like, because there's more than one building that
yes,
you're looking at. So can you describe what someone would be looking at in different areas?
Well, when they come in, I mean, you have the area where the production area where we bottle the wine, we storage the wine that and where the office are, and then people when they come in, they go right into the tour and they register for the tour, and the tour guys takes them through the cellars. The largest underground cellars in the country.
Ah.
Very, very impressive underground cellars. And when you see the wine, the barrels, the aging process, where you see all the champagne storage there, they show you how the champagne is made, how the port at age and then You go to the premium wines in the barrels room. So you take a tour and go to see all the different winemaking processing. And then you end up in another building, which is where the tasting room is and where you taste all the wines. And also you have an opportunity. It's a sales room, so you can buy the wines there. And then we have another area where we have a restaurant that we just ready to open now in April 1st. Beautiful place that is going to be serving the fancy, very nice French cuisine, and that is sitting in the dining room. Then we have another area where it's a bar and kind of tapas bar. And that's kind of more casual food. Then we have a terrace outside where people can sit down and look at the vineyards and enjoy the music. And so then we have other rooms where they have the bus group, so they can people come by groups, and so they can have a group party. And then we have an area outside also where they have the entertainment. And it's a lot of different places where people can enjoy and walk around to see the beautiful buildings, the house, the mansion that we have. And then we have a stone building. So it's like a village. It's beautiful to walk through a history.
Now, when you have have entertainment, like, just like as an idea, what do you bring in as far as entertainment?
We have many events, and for example, the one that's coming now, it started with Spring Flynn Dinner Dance. That's something that we have for the American Cancer Society on March 20, that people come, and it's a beautiful event. Then we have another one in April called Dancing with Wine, where guests get a professional dance lesson along with wine tasting and light fair. And that, you know, those are that specific event that we have. We have the John Lennon exhibit Saturday, April 3rd. And then we have other events that we organize with many other wineries, Pasta Primo Vino, which every winery present different pasta, and you go from winery to winery, tasting different wine with different food. And
that's fabulous.
It's those are great events, and people enjoy it. And normally they do it, they come in, when there are many wineries, they go in, they rent a van or a limousine, and they go around and they do all this tasting and tell the food that each winery present.
Now, when you say, like, going from winery to winery, are you looking at, like, within how many miles, would you say?
About 70 miles.
Okay.
The whole tours, and there are about 12 wineries.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know, you can do it in 2 days.
I was going to say, you can't do it all.
No, normally
one day
what people do, they come in, they stay in the bed and breakfast or in the hotel. And then they take their first day, they visit six winery one day and six winery the second day. And so it's, you know, you can do it. That's why it's a good idea to have a designated driver and go around. So,
and the designated drinker.
Yes, that's what somebody has to be sober.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of fun. People really look forward to those events.
I can imagine that. Do they also set up like the bed and breakfast that people stay in? I mean, do they?
Yes, we have all those things that we can arrange. You know, if you go to our website and we give all those links. For people to look into our website, it's brotherhoodwinery.net, and it's very it has a lot of different places where people can stay and fun place to stay also at a beautiful bed and breakfast. A lot of good restaurants besides the restaurant that we have here now. There are a lot of restaurants around the area where people can also enjoy a night when they go back to the hotel after tasting all this food.
They
I don't know.
They should also have like certain places where you stop and the restaurant like gives you a food to go.
Yes, yes. But that I think that you know, it's really nice. People,
yes.
People, they have a lot of fun. But the winery itself, our winery, has so much to offer in terms of even just to walk around the facilities with the buildings, the stone buildings, and then you have the cellars and you have the you know, the some of the historical the things that we have, like we for example have the one of the oldest steam generator, and the chimney is right there, so you can see it. So just walking around, you get a sense of history.
Sure.
And, right here in the Hudson Valley, that's what people don't realize, that so close to New York City, you have this most wonderful place, and people don't realize that if something like that exists in New York.
So where are you growing grapes?
Yeah, we have a vineyard. We grow a little bit of the grapes here, just but that's a small little vineyard. That is a garden of varieties. We have many different grapes varieties that you show people how grapes are grown. This is more to demonstrate. But our vineyard is we have 80 acres of vineyards that is by Olana Castle. I don't know if you are familiar with your audience knows, but Olana Castle is the house of Frederick Church, which is one of the Hudson Valley School of Painter. He built a house on top of the hill, like Persian-style castle that has the most beautiful view of the Hudson River. Our vineyard is right underneath there. So you can see actually the castle from our vineyard. We are closer to the river, and it's a beautiful site where we grow Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Riesling, and even Sangiovese, which is an Italian very rare grape that you normally don't see that here, but we grow all those grapes in our vineyard, and that's how those are the grapes that we use to make our finest wine.
Yeah. Well, Cesar, I detect this accent.
Well, I am.
How do you like that segue?
That's pretty good. We are also. I am. I was born in Chile, and I was. That's what my origin is. Although my origin goes even farther, a little bit to Europe. My part of my family was from Spain. And that where I end up going after I finished school in Chile, I went with a scholarship to study in Spain, in Madrid, and that's how I met my wife now, and she's from Brooklyn, for all places. So I end up. That's how we I end up here. But many years ago, so in my career, I ended up going from to California. I work in California, and from there I came to here to New York, where she's from. So you know why I'm here in New York and not in California.
And I understand there's a link with that, yeah, having to do with wines there.
Exactly. Well, it's besides, you know, we are also link to Chile, because we have wine also a vineyard. My partners and we have vineyards in Chile as well, and so we are also still connected with Chilean wines. And unfortunately, Chile, as you know, we had some terrible disaster right now. So it's not a good time for the poor people there. But what can we do? They are suffering tremendously. But in any case, hopefully we are not affected for the harvest this year, because now at this time of the year, they have the harvest now there in March. So they are very worried about that, being ready to harvest the grapes. But hopefully they can take care of the situation.
Let me get into these the wines that I'm going to sample right now.
Yes.
The first one I want to that I'm sampling is the Brotherhood Dry Riesling wine.
Yes.
Which is more unusual, because usually
most of the
sweeter.
Yeah, most of the time Riesling people expect to be a slightly sweet. In fact, that's our best selling is a sweet, the semi-sweet. The wine that, even if it has a touch of sweetness, the regular Riesling, it has a good finish, dryness, because of the nice acidity that the wine has. But this dry Riesling is so good. I mean, so clean, so crisp, and mineral the flavor that are very characteristic. Similar, a lot of people are familiar with Pinot Grigio. This is the Riesling. It has the same texture characteristic of the, but with a lot more flavor, more fruity, more aromatic. And it's so pleasant, and it doesn't have to be sweet. Like I say, it goes very well with food. So I don't know if you're tasting it now, but it's so nice, and has a nice balance in the mouth.
It does. I have it in front of me. I'm drinking it.
Yeah.
And I'm getting it. I like it that it goes down smoothly. It's very smooth.
Yes, yes.
It
doesn't have the sweetness that a lot of people, don't like, especially when they're having some food. Sometimes they don't want the sweet wine you can have it with seafood if you like, or a nice fish, flounder, and it goes very well with all that type of food that requires that type of acidity and crispy, a nice texture also.
Mm. Now, the second one I have, and I guess I don't know whether they say to compare, because it's not the same. I have the one from Chile, which is Casas, is it? Casas?
Casas Patronales.
Casas Patronales, yes.
Yes.
Which is a Sauvignon Blanc?
Yes. And that is that's a very, very nice, beautiful wine, also from Chile. So do you taste that
I just tasted it just now. It is. It's like, I have to think of how to describe it.
Yeah, I would describe it as a nice, herbaceous, grassy character, which is a little bit minty, very lemony.
Yes. Yes, yes.
And some have nice apple some apple notes, some nice tropical fruit.
Yeah.
Very very nice.
Because you're the winemaker, you can describe it better than I can.
it's a language that sometimes I don't know if we confuse people or describe it the way it is, but certainly that is one of my favorite wines, and that's what we send it to you, so, because I think it's outstanding. It's
one of the best.
The value is so very, very nice. And that's a little bit because come from a warmer climate than New York. It has more body, more alcohol. It's rounder, so it's a little different. That again go with different type of food, and that you can serve it with chicken, with veal, and that type of things. That white meat, and it goes very, very nice with that.
Mm.
So that every wine has a is for there is a wine for every food. and every mood.
Good.
And that's what depends on how you're feeling, how you, you know, what company, and what are you, how are you serving the wine. So that's what makes wine so interesting. When you have company, for example, it's nice to have a different wine with different dinner, with different dish. So if you have four dishes that you invite somebody and you have different dish, you have a different wine for different dish, and each wine has to match what you're serving.
Right.
And that's become a lot of fun when you do that, because then now you have, you know, a very good, make it simple meal become a feast.
Yeah. And the third thing I want to get into, you have all these specialty wines.
Yes.
Some that are actually just that are made with honey.
Yes, we have a honey wine, Carol Mead, especially now of St. Patrick's Day. You have this, the Irish has this, it's like a national drink, they call mead, which is made with 100% honey. Then we have another honey wine, but this is for the Ethiopian, and it's a little bit different style, fuller, more alcohol, more heavier, but goes very well with the Ethiopian spicy food, and that is called Chiva Tash, and that is it's very unique product. Then we have another product that is very, very special for us, very different. It's called ginseng wine.
That's the one I have.
And the ginseng wine is so, you know, it's, ginseng have a very good attribute for health purpose. And
Korean ginseng?
Korean ginseng,
mm-hmm.
Yes. And that's what people, you know, they get the benefit of the wine benefit and the ginseng. So what can be bad?
I mean, it's not ginseng flavored. It's ginseng. It's ginseng, made with ginseng.
Exactly. It's actual fresh ginseng. So it's not a flavor. It's actual ginseng
right.
extract that we get the 7-year-old root. It's very, very expensive. I don't know. Ginseng is the most expensive. To takes long time and is very expensive to acquire also.
Now,
but
being let me ask you something. Being that it's a red wine, what would you characterize as a red wine itself being? What category?
We have a red wine that is more like a slightly sweet, and I would think more like a vermouth. You know, it's Italian vermouth
mm-hmm.
with the ginseng extract,
mm-hmm.
and so it's a sweet and has a earthy taste.
Right.
Very like you know, when you grind, almost like a grind potato. It's got that type of flavor with a very distinctive root and. Like you say, because of the wine being so smooth, so good, and blend very well with the ginseng. And
yeah,
so
it,
the
it
two,
does.
They
I
kind
mean,
of give you the texture that a little bit of astringency in the mouth, so
right.
it's good texture.
Yes,
and,
I'm getting that, yeah.
And nice flavor at the end. The finish very, very pleasant.
Yeah, is that more of a wine that someone would have, let's say, if somebody's, you should have a glass of wine before you go to sleep, or if you,
yeah,
have, you should have a red wine. Would that be something to have for that purpose more than to drink it with a meal?
Yes, it's definitely it's not a meal wine. I would say it's what you call the Italian and French call it aperitif. You can have
mm-hmm.
it before just open your appetite.
Right.
At the beginning with some hors d'oeuvres, have some things that you can have, or you can have it at the end of the meal as the digestif. A digestif
right.
is something you have after the meal.
Right.
And that kind of, as you drink that just like a tea at the end of the meal, I feel very, very
sure.
soothing and very pleasant to end up with that. That's how you... you serve that, and this is. I also like to have that sometimes with like Campari. You have with seltzer with a little bit of put some cranberry and a little bit of seltzer. And that's
okay.
Very nice drink, like an aperitif over on the rocks. So it's very refreshing and very nice, in the morning, you know, you take that as a for lunch, like they do it in Europe normally. It's Sunday morning, you go and have your digestive aperitif in the plaza. So
uh-huh.
That's it. So now the springtime come, it's very nice. Now we have another wine that is for spring that I don't think you have it, which is called May wine.
Oh, yeah, I tasted that,
and
didn't I?
May
I
wine
yeah.
is, I don't know if you got that, but that's also wonderful. Made with the fresh strawberries and
yes.
and woodruff. Woodruff is a herb that has, that they use in normally to steep it like a tea in the wine.
Mm-hmm.
And we use a nice base wine. We use a native a grape called Catawba, which has an apple flavor, very tangy flavor with the sweet and tangy and the strawberries. It's very refreshing, beautiful wine to celebrate spring time.
Now, do you ever have do the thing with like wine and cheeses, an event that?
Yes, we have a lot of events that include cheeses and that type of thing. But now that we have the restaurant, we're going to leave that to him. I mean, the chef is a French chef. He's going to make his own bread and baguette. He's and he has the most wonderful cheeses there, and that's one of the things that are going to be served there in the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be one of his signature part dishes, which you have cheeses and croissant and baguette, all this type of bread with nice cheeses, different flavors.
Is he going to go after like a variety of cheeses that are not necessarily local?
Yes, he's going to go with more international cheeses, whether
mm-hmm.
it's Manchego. Brie on that. I don't know what, but he's very, very exquisite to when
right.
it comes to choosing that right type of cheese with that right type of wine. So he's going to, that's going to be one of his specialties. And obviously we're going to include some. They're excellent local cheese. So
mm-hmm.
in the Hudson Valley, they are very several. So I want to make sure that we also incorporate that as part of the. You know, it's no reason to be, you know, we are very proud of the cheeses that produce locally. So that's going to be part of the menu as well.
So have we ever gotten to the point where he's like sat down and paired the cheeses with your wines to see what he can choose, or he's not even at the...
Well, we have been doing that informally.
Oh, okay.
And because I, you know, that's my pastime. I go there to check things. So it's one of the things
okay.
that I like to do. And I think that we both said in the same line in that aspect because, you know, wine and food is perfect marriage. So, and we are both very, very demanding when it comes to that. And we like to do it. And the main thing, we want to do it very affordable. So it's not overpriced. People think that the fact that sometimes you have Frenchmen cooking is going to be expensive. This is going to be, we're going to make it very, very reasonable. So I think it's going to be a great addition to the
yeah,
to the
I
winery.
Think so. Oh, and what about do you think he'll like make purposely make any like Chilean dish to pair with the Chilean wine?
I would think so. I think that's something that, I like to keep, we're going to be demanding a lot of different things, that specialty, and modify those menus according to the event that we have, because we do have a lot of international events. Also, with one event that called Around the World 60 Miles, where each winery around in this trail that we have, they become a country. and we take the custom of that country, and then we cook the food of that country.
Wow.
We dress like the music. Is that also another very great event? And we do, most of the time we like to represent Chile because we feel comfortable.
Sure.
But now, and since he's French, he might also be like to be French, France. So we have to see what we do.
Now, as far as all these things that are happening, going to happen, if we go to brotherwinery.net, will all these events come up, or should I direct people to Orange County Tourism for this?
Either way, I think both we are work together with Orange County Tourism. They do promote the event, and they promote the region. But in our Brotherhood Winery .net, you will see, try to keep all these events current.
Okay.
But both places are good source for to getting the information. And I think that you will find that is the trip to the Hudson Valley is really worth being so close. You don't even, you think about going to other countries when sometimes you have some of the most beautiful views and sight right here, 1 hour north of Manhattan.
Yeah, that's
amazing.
That's true. That's very true.
So yeah. I'm pretty sure, Meryl, you got a few, you got a taste of a little bit of that.
I certainly did. And you know, I'll be back to check out the restaurant. I'll do that. That's for sure.
Very good. You're really, really going to have a taste of the Hudson.
Okay. And then I'll report back on that as well.
Very good.
Okay. Thank you so much, Cesar. Do you pronounce your name Cesar?
Cesar Baeza.
Okay.
That's the name is. I like to invite all your audience to come here and look me up and maybe get the chance to say hello and we show you what we have here in terms of the beautiful wines and buildings. I think you will have a great visit, especially when some events are going on. That makes it even more festive.
Okay, and actually the town for people is actually Washingtonville.
Washingtonville.
That's the town
itself. Yes, and that we are really exactly 60 miles from the George Washington Bridge.
Oh, okay.
North. And that we exit 16, the thruway, and then take Route 17, and that exit 130. So that is really a nice ride, and we're looking forward to entertain you here.
Great. Thank you so much, Cesar.
Thank you, Mary.
I'll see you. Again.
Very good. Looking forward to seeing you all.
Take care.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. So it's really, isn't that really cool? I mean, I know there are wineries and a lot of wineries in California that do things, but it's always great to know that if you're in New York City and you want to do a day trip out of New York City, there's a lot to do in the Hudson Valley area. And if you want to for Orange County, it would be orangetourism.org, and you could see the events that are coming up. In the meantime, I'm waiting for Michael to call in. It's time. Again, we're talking about, as I once said before, hair has is going to have a brand new cast. It's first time that a Broadway show had changed the entire cast, and here is just about one of my favorite songs.
We starve to look at one another short of breath, walking proudly in our winter coats, wearing smell from Labrador. stories facing a dying nation of moving paper fantasy, listening for the new tall lies with supreme visions of lonely tunes. Somewhere inside something there is a rush of greatness. Who knows what stands in front of our lives? I fashion my future on film.
Shows Love, Loss, and What I Wore till March 28th. If you happen to be in New York City, has that wonderful cast with Fran Drescher, and it's open end, changes like every 4 weeks. So and we'll always have an all star cast. Now there was one monologue that was done by Fran Drescher, which absolutely got to me, having to do with people buying people buying purses. It's entitled, I Hate My Purse. I would like to read this to you. I hate my purse. I absolutely hate it. If you're one of those women who think there's something great about purses, don't even bother listening because I have nothing to say to you. This is for women who hate their purses, who are bad at purses, who understand that their purses are reflections of negligent housekeeping, hopeless disorganization, a chronic inability to throw anything away, and an ongoing failure to handle the obligations of a demanding and difficult accessory. The obligation, for example, that it should in some way match what you're wearing. This is for women whose purses are a morass of loose Tic Tacs, Advils, lipsticks without tops, little bits of tobacco, even though there has been no smoking going on for at least 10 years, tampons that have come loose from their wrappings, boarding passes from long-forgotten airplane trips, hotel keys from God knows what hotel, leaky ballpoint pens, Kleenexes that either have or have not been used, but there's no way to be sure one way or the other. This is for those of you who understand, in short, that your purse is, in some absolute way, horrible way, you. Or as Louis the Fourth, might have put it, but didn't because he was much too smart to carry a purse. Le sac, c'est moi. I realized many years ago that I was no good at purses, and for quite a while, I did without one. When I went out at night, I managed with only a lipstick, a $20 bill, and a credit card tucked into my bra. But unfortunately, there were times when I needed to leave the house with more than just the basics. So I bought an overcoat with large pockets. This, I realized, turned my coat into a purse. But it was still better than carrying a purse. Anything is better than carrying a purse. Because here's what happens with a purse. You start small. You start pledging yourself to neatness. You start vowing that this time it will be different. You start with a wallet and a few cosmetics. But within seconds, your purse has accumulated the debris of your lifetime. The cosmetics have somehow fallen out of their shiny cosmetic bag. The coins have tumbled from the wallet. The credit cards are somewhere. Where? Where are they? There's a half-drunk bottle of water along with several snacks you saved from an airplane trip, just in case you ever found yourself starving and unaccountably craving a piece of cheese that tastes like plastic. Perhaps you can fit your sneakers into your purse. Yes, by God, you can. Before you know it, everything you own is in your purse. You can flee the Cossacks with your purse. But when you open it up, you can't find a thing. Your purse is a big dark hole full of stuff that you spend hours fishing around for. What's the solution? I tried spending quite a lot of money on a purse, the theory being that having an expensive purse would inspire me to become a different person, but that didn't work. I also tried one of those Prada backpack purses, but I stuffed it so much into it, I looked like a Sherpa. Then one day I found myself in Paris with a friend who announced that her goal for the week was to buy a vintage Kelly bag. I'd never heard of a Kelly bag. My friend looked at me as if I had spent a century asleep in a cave, and she explained a Kelly bag was a Hermes bag first made in the 1950s that Grace Kelly had made famous, hence the name. It was a classic. My friend had heard that there was a dealer in the flea market who had several for sale. How much is this purse going to cost, I asked. I practically expired when she told me about $3,000. Well, we went to the flea market, and there was the Kelly bag. I didn't know what to say. It looked like the sort of bag my mother used to carry. It barely held anything, and it hung stiffly on my friend's arm. I may not be good at purses, but I know that any purse that hangs over your arm instead of on your shoulder immobilizes half your body. And more important, it adds 10 years. Anyway, my friend bought her Kelly bag. It cost only $2,600. The color wasn't exactly what she wanted, but it was in wonderful shape. Of course, it would have to be waterproofed immediately because it would lose half its value if it got caught in the rain. Waterproofed? Caught in the rain? It never crossed my mind to worry about a purse being caught in the rain. Well, thank God it was time for lunch. We all went to a bistro, and the Kelly bag was placed in the center of the table, where it sat like a small shrine to a shopping victory. And then outside it began to rain. My friend's eyes began to well with tears. Her lips closed tightly. In fact, to be completely truthful, her lips actually pursed. It was pouring rain, and she hadn't had the Kelly bag waterproofed. She would have to sit there all afternoon and wait for the rain to end rather than expose the bag to a droplet of moisture. It crossed my mind that she and her Kelly bag might have to sit there forever. She would get old, although her Kelly bag would not, and eventually she and the bag would, like some modern version of Lot's wife, metamorphose into a monument to what happens to people who care too much about purses. At that point, I gave up. I came back to New York and bought myself a purse. Well, it's not a purse exactly. It's a bag. It's definitely the best bag I have ever owned. It's yellow and blue, so it matches nothing at all, and therefore, on a deep level, matches everything. It's made of vinyl and is completely waterproof. It is equally unattractive in all seasons of the year. It costs next to nothing. Like $26, and it will never have to replace, and you'll never have to replace it, because it seems to be completely indestructible. What's more, never having been in style, it can never go out of style. It doesn't work for everything, I admit. On rare occasions, I'm forced to use a purse, one that I hate. But mostly I go everywhere with my yellow and blue vinyl bag. And wherever I go, people say to me, "I love that bag. Where did you get that bag?" That is the greatest bag. The MetroCard bag. Buy one. Well, that gives you an idea of one of the things that's talked about in the show, Love, Loss, and What I Wore. Okay, I'm going to take a quick commercial break here. One of my other sponsors.
Thank you for calling JetBlue. May I help you?
My cousin was telling me you guys have extra legroom.
Uh-huh. We have extra legroom as compared to a normal coach seat.
Okay. If I don't have an extra leg, can I use that room for something else?
No. That is not what the extra leg implies. We took out one whole row of seats, and that gave the rest of those rows a couple of extra inches of legroom.
Ah.
I understand what you mean. The words extra leg imply that, but it has nothing to do with having an extra leg.
I'm a pretty literal person.
Uh-huh. Well, that would be taking it very literally.
I guess a little too literally.
Okay. Is there anything else I can help you with?
I think that's it. You've been pretty helpful.
Thanks for calling JetBlue.
Dear traveler, stretch out. We now have the most legroom in coach. Visit us at JetBlue.com. Sincerely, JetBlue, based on average fleet-wide seat pitch of U.S. Airlines.
I keep waiting for JetBlue to send me another one of their humorous commercials like that. I love that commercial. Well, before our next caller gets called in, I'm sorry, the Michael from Bear Mountain Inn wasn't able to call on the air. There's some dinner going on that he has to handle, and it's okay. We'll talk about a Bear Mountain in on my next show. Well, this is still Women's History Month, so here's another song.
She may be the face I can't forget, a trace of pleasure or regret, maybe my treasure or the price I have to pay. She may be the song the summer sings, maybe the chill the autumn brings, maybe 100 different things within the measure of a day. She may be the beauty or the beast, maybe the famine or the feast, may turn each day into a heaven or a hell. She may be the mirror of my dreams, the smile reflected in a stream. She may not be what she may seem inside her shell.
In Tulsa and an area that that's part of the Cherokee Nation there. We'll see about that. So what we're waiting for? What are we waiting? Oh yes, yeah, because our next caller will be Ruth from the Gomez Mill House, and she's gonna basically, I guess, give us a history tour. Let's see. I have to write some commercials, I think. I guess. But in the meantime, let's see. So it's only about a month away. It's only a month away before the New York Sharks open their season, the season opener. The Sharks will be on the road. Their first game is actually going to be played in Philadelphia. And then we'll be home. And at that time, Samantha Rappaport, who works for the NFL, she works for the youth division on the NFL, and she'll be at the game. And we're going to have some flag football demonstrations, a little bit of playing scrimmage, and we're inviting this whole particular season. We're going to be inviting a lot of kids, teenagers, females, teams, non-teams, to participate or just show up in the schools and really enjoy the season. But now let's go back, and I believe we have Ruth on the phone right now. Hi, Ruth.
Hello, Meryl. How are you?
Oh, just fine. I hope I can do this all in a half an hour.
Well, I'm sure we can make it interesting and fast enough
okay.
to get through.
the basic thing, I want you to tell us what the Gomez Mill House is.
Sure. The Gomez Mill House is a historic house and historic site located in Marlborough, New York, which is in Orange County. And the Mill House is, in fact, the oldest historic house in Orange County and the oldest standing Jewish dwelling in North America. It was founded in 1714 by Louis Moses Gomez, one of the early colonial Jewish leaders in New York and in the New World. And it was then, over a period of nearly 300 years, the home of revolutionary patriots, of wealthy leisure class families, of a very well-known arts and crafts artisan, and a social activist. And then it became a private home and got on the National Register through her efforts, the wife's efforts, and then was sold to some family descendants of Louis Gomez, who created the museum, created a foundation to support it, and here we are today.
Wow. So basically, give us like the basic background of who the ones that were coming in.
Sure. This is all very exciting. Unlike most homes, historic houses in the United States where we celebrate a specific event like Washington slept here, or a specific activity, one stop on the Underground Railroad, or a home of a very famous family like Hyde Park with the Roosevelts, the Mill House had five key historic owners who did something beyond themselves that contributed to the history and the development of America, or represented the founding principles of America. And these were Louis Gomez, I mentioned to you, who was the child of some Spanish Jews the father had been an advisor to the King of Spain. And in 1654, during the Inquisition, the king told him that he could only protect him for so long and then he would have to leave. And there would be a secret saying that the king would convey to Louis Gomez's father, Isaac, which was, "Gomez, the onions are beginning to smell." And if he got that message, it was to get out of town, which he did, and he shipped his family to
France, which he then followed 3 years later after being captured and then escaping. And then the family moved from France to England, where Gomez grew up, and then subsequently came to the New World, got himself a wife and had a family, and then came to New York in 1703. We have a very famous document called the Denization, which gave him the rights and privileges of citizens of the colony without becoming a citizen, because as a Jew, he would not be able to do that in the name of the Church of England. And then when he died in 1740, the sons, at his request in the will, sold the properties, and it went into the hands after a few years, after about 30 years, into the hands of a revolutionary leader in Orange County named Wolfert Acker. And Wolfert Acker was an enterprising fellow. He had a mill. He ran packet boats on the Hudson. He had the first ferry boat ride across the Hudson from Newburgh to Beacon. He did many, many things up there, and in fact was a revolutionary leader for George Washington. Many of your listeners may know that Washington's headquarters was in fact in Newburgh. And we know that Wolfert Acker held meetings at the house where he would recruit Minutemen, he would hold secret meetings, and then after the war he became one of the first politicians of the new colony and a selectman, and then continued his enterprises there. His son succeeded him at the house, and in about 1840, the family sold the property to a wealthy leisure class family known as the Armstrongs. And the Armstrongs came from England originally, fought in the Revolutionary War, had generals and all kinds of wonderful people, and were very wealthy. And Edward Armstrong bought the property from Acker along the Hudson River and westward toward where our mill house is on the western border of the property, about a mile inland. And his wife, coming up from the south, took one look at our quaint rustic house, which by then had a second story on it, because Acker and his family, Acker had put a brick second story and attic up. And the wife looked at it and said, "Oh, I don't think so. I think I want a large southern mansion type thing," which the husband, Edward, then built on what's called Donskammer Point, and that's a very famous point along the Hudson in Newburgh, which was seen actually by Henry Hudson in 1609 as he rode up the Hudson in the Half Moon. And when they had children, and one of their sons, when he was old enough to return from his wanderings, took himself a wife, and they gave him our house as a wedding present, and he and his wife lived there. They had a little girl who at the age of 5 tripped and fell near the creek and actually died. We have a little marker for her, and it was all very sad. And then they the family owned the property through the early 1900s, and it went into the hands of a man named John Staples first, who was a member of the arts and crafts movement up there. And he sold the house to this very famous paper historian and papermaker named Dard Hunter. And it's Dard Hunter who built the paper mill that we have on our property in the style of a lovely English cottage on our little pond with a waterfall. And it was there that, through the creek and the waterfall, he was able to mill his own paper. He did research from there. He was very well known as a paper historian around the world. And discovered shortly after, maybe 3 or 4 years after living there and trying to mill his paper and do his work, that the creek wasn't really strong enough to produce much paper. So he only produced 500 sheets of paper, believe it or not. But he left the property, he sold the property, and he went back to Ohio. And then the property went into the hands of a social activist, a fascinating woman by the name of Martha Greening, which is actually spelled Gruning, but it's pronounced Greening. She came from a very, very strong activist family tradition, and she was a graduate of Vassar in the late 1800s. She was a suffragette. She fought for workers' rights. She fought for racial rights. She was a Jewish woman from a Jewish family who had actually been part of the movement along with the early black leaders of the freedom tradition, and she actually partnered and worked with another group of other white founders and supporters of the NAACP, along with, of course, W.E.B. Du Bois and many other, as I said, very strong supporters, black supporters of the racial freedom activity. And then, so she co-authored several articles with him in The Crisis, which was the magazine of the NAACP. And she also wrote several books on workers' rights, mining rights, terrible things that happened in, throughout the country with terrible working conditions. And she actually adopted a young child, a black child from an acting family, and had hoped to open a libertarian school at the house. And that didn't quite work out. We have an ad, but we don't think the school actually opened. So she left the home, not to give it away, but she left it in the hands of friends while she went to Europe, and the child went with her. And when he died in the diphtheria epidemic in the mid-1920s, she returned to New York and sold the house. And then it kind of went here and there for a while, and then it went into the private hands of a family after World War II named the Starrins. And Millie Starrin raised her, she and her husband raised their children at the house. They slept in the historic rooms, and they played on the historic property. And at one point, Millie decided that this wonderful house with its great history really should be on the National Register. This is an enormous effort. And Millie made that effort, and she gathered the research, and she went through the process and succeeded in getting the house put on the National Register. And while she was doing her research, she discovered that some of the leading corporate leaders and philanthropists in New York were, in fact, of all things, descendants of Luis Gomez. So she
Yeah.
And this included Joe Coleman, who was at the time chairman of Philip Morris, and Michael Cardozo IV, and a number of other prominent Jewish families in New York. And when they were contacted by Millie, they were so astounded and so delighted that some of them got together and suggested that they buy the property from Millie, who actually was looking to sell it, a little entrepreneurial activity going on there. And at her suggestion, of course, set it up as a museum, and they created a foundation, a nonprofit foundation to own and operate it, which is what I run today, along with the Mill House.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a fabulous, wonderful, beautiful site, very pastoral, and just a gorgeous place to visit.
So now,
both historically and physically.
Yeah. So now, when somebody coming for a tour, basically, what will they see?
Well, they'll see two main historic structures: the Dart Hunter Mill, which actually will be in restoration over the next 2 to 3 months. It will be fully operational in June. We'll have a dedication day. And the main house, which on the lower floor was the original Gomez Block House, which was a trading post. And then, of course, the second stories, and from the outside you will see the third story, which is the attic, which was built by Wilfred Acker with his own brick, which he made on the property. Has Dutch hex sign on it. You'll see many characteristics of Dutch architecture, not specifically Dutch colonial, but other Dutch influenced architecture. You'll see the Armstrong addition, which was the kitchen and a little porch area, and also the lovely landscaping, which the Armstrongs did, we suspect, with the help of A.J. Downing, but we have not yet proven that. But the beautiful neoclassical landscaping, return to nature, the rolling stone wall and rolling front lawn, really reflects neoclassical influence. And A.J. Downing had his home and the center of his work down the road in Newburgh. So we think that there was a connection, but we're still hunting for that. And they'll also see some and hear about the work of Martha Greening. And we have photographs and artifacts from all of these
owners, and we have a special room, a library, which was the original library and workspace of Dart Hunter. And we have many of his original watermarks and two copies of his very famous Handmaking in America book, which he produced by hand. He milled and produced the paper. He created the fonts, and then he created the printing of the work and the typeface. He then bound it, and all by hand, all by himself. So it's a really remarkable. We have people from all over the world who come just to see the Dart Hunter material.
Yeah, I also, there was also the first room, the first, like, I guess a separate building that that had the movie.
Yes, we have a little visitor center, which was, we believe, a smoke shed at one time. It has a stone wall, which would probably put it back to the Acker period.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe it might have been a smoke shed when Gomez was there, and I was going to say.
Yeah, I don't know that it goes back that far. It possibly could, but we're not sure. We don't carbon date these, so and we don't have a floor plan for the Gomez period. We have more of the Acker. So it was there when Acker was there, but we don't know if Acker built it or it was inherited from the Gomez period. But we do show a wonderful 15-minute video of the history of the site prior to everybody's tour. And
well,
then,
I was kind of, because I kind of thought that if it was a smoke shed while Gomez was there, I was going to say, and thus Lox was brought to the New World.
Yes, I don't think that would have been the original Lox from brought in, but it would be a great story, wouldn't it? That would be a great story.
Yeah.
We also have one of the few surviving coal cellars, root cellars, that have not collapsed in. We have that locked up, but we do open it for guests when they come to visit. And there's another small structure we refer to as the ice house, which is another stone wall structure that goes into the hillside. And again, we don't know exactly. We just know it was there going at least back to Acker, possibly back to Gomez. The original mill that Gomez had doesn't exist, but we do have a mill stone. And the same with the Acker mill, which was probably used for timber and for gristing, that also is not there. The only mill that we have is the Dart Hunter mill.
Now, there's an area like where the cooking was done, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. We have in the Armstrong kitchen area, this is in the annex to the Acker structure, a kitchen where we have, I guess you could say, a panorama of eating habits, of cooking traditions going back from the early period, probably if we look at Gomez, but surely from the Acker family period of 1772 through to Millie Sterin and her 1940s kitchen, where she produced her food for her family. So we have a whole row of different kinds of cooking utensils, some of them fascinating antiques, a cabbage slicer, really fascinating 1880 toaster, things of this sort, and people really love the kitchen. They're fascinated by all of the different artifacts that we have in there.
Well, Esther, my rubber chicken, must have been very fascinated, and she must have been hungry. She thought she was going to get fed. I caught her sitting in the high chair.
You did?
Yes.
Well, it's a good thing she didn't get too close to the oven, Meryl.
Yeah. Oh, you're not kidding. I have a photo of her in the high chair. Just,
oh, you
know.
Do?
Yes,
you
I do.
That
I
one
mean,
in. Yeah,
I,
you
yeah.
snuck that one in.
I'll tell you, she gets into everything. That's
yeah, I know you. I caught you catching her taking a few pictures around the property. I missed the one in the high chair.
I thought so. Which leads me to, in terms of this type of place, it's not a don't touch, is it? Except for like don't sit on chairs,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
You know.
Well, the artifacts are around, and people can move in and around them. We ask them not to sit on any of the furniture. We do allow people to sometimes touch some of the more traditional artifacts that we have. Like in the kitchen, they can pick up the spoon, or they can pick up a one of the egg beaters or something of that sort.
Right.
But most of the material is certainly accessible, but and very much within range. But it's really not something that we pick up and turn around with our own hands.
I would imagine not.
We're much more accessible than some museums, but we're not a real hands-on museum like a children's museum would be.
Right,
we do have children's days though, where we have an archaeology for children's day this in the summer, and we demonstrate papermaking. We don't use the actual beaters of that Dart Hunter did. We use blenders, but it shows how paper is made. And what Dard would have done if, in terms of the final product. And we also do that. We have 1,000 children from the Newburgh School System come in every year for the last 15 years, the third graders, for their local history experience. And they just are fascinated. In fact, they elected to come to our house, which we're very pleased about and very honored about, because there are so many wonderful historic sites in the area. And the kids just love coming to the Mill House. And they have been doing it for 15 years, and we're about to start the next group on April 7th.
How, in terms of just distance-wise, so people get an idea,
sure.
How do you, from New York City, in other words, let's say, I don't know if it's happened, like, have you ever had any school trips from New York City?
Sure, we have school trips, we have adult groups, we have general groups from all kinds of institutions, from synagogues, from community groups, from social groups. I just took a reservation for a group from a Y that's coming up, that they're going to come up at the end of the summer. We have Elder Hostel come up. For instance, there's an elder hostel in Queens that just inquired about coming up for the day. And what they do is they come here and then they do one or two other activities in the local area. We have a couple of wineries just across the street down the road from us. There are, of course, as I said, many historic sites.
So they come up, they go to your place, go to the winery, and get chicka, huh?
Well, they can, I guess. Not the children,
okay.
But I guess they can do that on their soda.
Yeah, that's it.
But there's a great wine tasting both at Kedem and Ben Marl wineries, which are right across from us.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Next time when I come up there, the only winery I went to was Brotherhood Winery.
Uh-huh, that's a little farther away.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I had Cesar was on the show earlier.
Oh, really?
To talk about the Brotherhood Winery, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's a wonderful place.
Yeah, it was.
Really.
As I sit here being shikka from tasting some of the wines he had sent me
to
check out.
Well, there you go. You could do a whole tour and, roll yourself home, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, that's, I guess, the great thing about taking Metro North and going up there.
Yes. Well, we're on the other side of the river. We're actually
right.
On the west side of the river, across from the Beacon Bridge. And so there's not too much public transportation, unfortunately, in the region. That's one of our real deficits up there. And I know that there are many people, talking about how to fix that problem, because with so many wonderful places to visit and only being able to get there by car, it makes it a little more difficult to get people out there. But if you do have the wheels, if you do have the car and can do it, it's just a great place to visit, the whole region, actually.
Oh, yeah, it certainly is. It's certainly a lot to do. And just to make sure I get this in, what's the website of your...
Right, our website is, of course, www.gomez.org. And we are, like everyone else, updating our website. So we actually have a new front page, a new opening page, and a place where you can click on that says archival site. And eventually they'll be merged. But right now you can get some basic information on the front page, on the opening page, and then you can click on the archival site and get to all of the historical material that we have. We're about an hour and 15 minutes from New York City, from a number of different routes. You can go up the New York State Thruway 87. You can go up the Taconic and then across the Newburgh Bridge. It's not a difficult trip. It's a lovely trip. I do it at least 3-4 times a week from down in the Manhattan area where I live, and we also have an office in Manhattan for the foundation. And I find it's just a great trip.
I'm curious if the office at the foundation is just an office, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's like no.
No, it's an administrative office. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
It's where we do our fundraising, where we work on our public relations. If I have meetings with people who are interested in supporting us, I can do that in Manhattan as well as up in Lower Hudson Valley.
Right.
It's basically an administrative office.
Mm-hmm. Now, the property itself is how many acres?
Our current property is 18 acres, is the historic core, which it houses the structures. We have a 26-acre parkland, which we will develop as soon as we can get some funding, which is adjacent to us, and we purchased that to help fight sprawl that would endanger the historic structures. And we did that in concert with a wonderful group called Scenic Hudson, who took a farm easement on a farm to the north west of us called the Alpha Orchard. And so now in perpetuity, the historic core is protected from any development. So I guess to answer your question, we have about 56 acres of the original 6,500 acres that Gomez owned.
And do you do any, like, kind of outdoor event kind of a thing?
We're waiting to get our funding. We were given a wonderful grant from the state, and we're in the process of having that money released, you know, to us. And once we get that, we have plans to build a parking lot on the property, the larger property,
mm-hmm.
which will allow us to have more parking for visitors. Right now, we have parking on the historic core behind the house, and that allows us to have small events. As I said, we have a program called Sundays at Mill House, which we will be putting up on the website once we confirm all of the activity, probably in about 2 weeks. We have lectures, we have event days. As I said, we'll have archaeology for children, we'll have a papermaking day, we have lectures by some authors and specialists who are, and the subjects span all of the five historic owners' activities. So they're not directly about the owners, but perhaps something that would lend itself to subjects that would be inspired by the owners.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things I had noticed that I found of interest is a couple of areas where you can see the layers on the walls.
Oh, yes. When we restored the mill house itself in 2001, we kept certain portions of the walls, I guess, where you can see it mostly, although we have some floor exhibits, where you see the archaeological layering. So you see the original Gomez stone wall with its original mud mortar. And then you would see in the background, and then you would see in layers coming forward some of the Acker plaster, and then some of the Armstrong wallpaper, for instance. And then the last bit would be the plaster that Millie had put on the wall, the kind of plaster of Paris stucco that she had put on. So you can actually see these layerings in two places, one in the main room, which was the Gomez blockhouse, and then up on the second floor in our archaeological hallway, where we have archaeological exhibits of artifacts that were found around the property, you know, including Dutch pipes and buttons and coins, things of that sort.
Nice.
And then you have the wall with the layering, where you can really see the Dutch, the Acker brick, and then the layerings after that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I saw with the flooring, there's an area that you could see the actual first layer of nothing.
Yeah, one of the fascinating things about Gomez is that although they dealt mostly in commodities, they had come north with his son. He had bought the property to expand the business, and the timber and the lime business that he enterprises that he developed up there actually provided much of the resources for the building of New York down the Hudson. But his blockhouse, his trading post, which we have, of course, as the base of the mill house, was one of the few structures at that time that had a solid floor. Most of them had dirt floors. And what he did was he put lime on the floor, and so that entire large area was, in fact, a lime hard, almost a cement-like floor. And we have an exhibit of that in the floor, which we light up, and people can see the actual floor from Luis Gomez and from 1714. And it's quite fascinating because you don't think of this kind of development going on in the
1700s. So with the trading post, we're talking about Native Americans. There,
yes,
there.
He would have traded with a number of people that were up there, including some of the Native Americans that were left in the region. There weren't a whole lot left in the region by 1714 in the lower Hudson. They were mostly up in the upper Hudson regions. But we had a few outposts in
the
area.
They probably went, too close to the city.
Well, there was trading. There actually were Native American trade. Yes, that's right. It was beginning. The sprawl was beginning to get to them already.
they said, it's the stink. It's my stinkina. Get out of here. It's coming up from the city.
The neighborhood's getting too crowded. To move upstream. But they did have some. Actually, there are people I know doing research on the Native trading. Post areas along the river, there were where Native Americans would come and do their trading. But they also traded with people who were colonizing, going up north or heading north to go out west. And it was a very active trail. The old post road was a very active trail. And his trading post was a good commodities stopover for people traveling along that road. No doubt.
Mm-hmm. So again, we go to gomez.org. Is that what
gomez.org?
Uh-huh.
We're open from August officially to the public from April 18th through October 31st. We'll try to keep it open to November 7th, but we're having a conference that day.
Mm-hmm.
So in Manhattan on Jewish merchants in the New World, 19th century. We had our first conference last year, and this is our second in our series. So if we can, we'll keep it open to the 7th of November because it's so beautiful up there at that time of year.
Yeah.
And we are, as I said, about an hour and 15 minutes from the city. And you can go to the website for directions. And we hope everybody will join us. We are going to be open prior to the official opening date for the week between the first day and the last day of Passover. So because a lot of the Jewish schools are out and on vacation, and this gives them an opportunity to come up.
Good. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, I appreciate you calling in and telling us all about this.
Well, I'm delighted for the opportunity, and it was great to see you and to take you around and have you see the house along with your friend. And we will we hope to see you and
your
friend
back. along with the... Yep.
And we invite all of your visitors.
If
your visitors come and tell us that they heard this interview and they're a great fan of yours, we will give them the discounted price of $5
okay.
for adults. Yes. $5
Fantastic.
Instead of $7.50, and children are $2. Children and students are $2.
Okay, cool.
All right.
Worth
every
bit of it.
All right. Thank you, Meryl.
Yes, thanks again.
All
Have a good evening, Ruth.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, so that was the, you got enough information on the Gomez Mill House, and now we're ready to run. Oh, I did. That's right. You, Gail, you weren't there when I called the race.
Yes, I'm here.
But I'm saying you weren't there when I called the race.
Oh, gosh, no, I didn't. I missed that, and I am so sorry about that. But I bet you did it to perfection.
I did a great job. I took on that role.
Well, we find so many of our visitors, and especially the children, just love to call a race and see what it's like, and it's not that easy. You know, not everybody's a Roger Houston, so but they get a lot of practice.
Well, the part that I had a problem was is looking at and trying to pronounce the name of a horse.
That's true.
To make sure I said it correctly.
It can get, and some of these long ones, the long names like Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe, that gets very, very difficult to say, especially, you know, several times around the racetrack. So you have to practice hard.
Anyway, so introduce yourself to my audience.
Yes, I'm delighted to be here, and my name is Gail Kennard, and I'm the director at the Harness Racing Museum and Hall of Fame in Goshen, New York.
Okay, so tell me, what the hell is this museum? What is it?
Well, it goes back a long way. It goes back to the time when Young America began, and the inhabitants, the local inhabitants of each town throughout the United States needed some entertainment on a Saturday night, and they didn't really have much for entertainment. They don't have what we have. They don't have the televisions. They don't have they don't have all sorts of luxury entertainments that we now have. And so they looked around, and what did they have? Well, they had a really good trotter, or they had a really good pacing horse, and that was the old guy or the old girl that used to take them to the downtown Main Street to buy their goods, and the doctor to go to his patients, and the farmer to take his goods to market. They had good old Bess or good old Bill. And what did they do? They took good old Bess and good old Bill out to the racetrack and said, "My horse is faster than your horse," sometimes we do today down some of the highways. Some of these guys go roaring down the highways. And that's how harness racing began. It began in the early 1800s, and it is the true American sport. Believe it or not, it was the national pastime well before baseball. Can you believe that? So we are we chronicle the history of this young nation's very first pastime, harness racing, or trotting, as it was called. And we have a museum that celebrates that sport. What is interesting to note, and I'm sure all your listeners know about Currier and Ives, great lithographers of the 1800s, and, of course, many of their prints are still around today and calling for very nice prices on each one, and I'm sure many of your listeners are collectors of them. Well, believe it or not, 10% of every of their lithographic output was of the trotting horse, because they were trotting men. They loved the sport just the same way just most of the inhabitants of the country at that time did.
Great.
So
now,
that's the story.
let's talk about the highlights of what people will see at the museum.
Okay. Wow, it's a lot of fun. There's a lot of interactive exhibits, and it's a great place to bring children. It will take at least 2 hours, if not more, to go around the museum to see the story of harness racing, how it began, what it is today, some of the great people, the great horses that have been involved, and some of the great stories that are there about the sport. There is a lot of touchy-feely stuff for the children to do. We have call a race. We have judge a race. We have three theaters, one of which I know that you were very enthralled with, which was harness racing in Hollywood. And that we even see John Wayne sitting on a sulky, which is the little vehicle that pulls our standardbreds, our horses, our trotters, and our pacers. You see Lucille Ball, and she had a standardbred, and she's trying to drag him up the stairs so Ricky doesn't catch her with this horse that she's got for her young son. We have the one of the finest things we have is really coming back today, and I'm sure many of your listeners have seen, because I saw it and it was awesome, Avatar, the 3D movie. Avatar 3D is coming back. Well, guess what? We have a 3D simulator that you sit in the driver's seat and you can pretend and you can have the feeling of being in an actual harness race. And the wind goes through your hair. The horseshoes come flying out at you.
Yeah.
Around the turns. You remember it?
Yes,
you had
I
a good
do.
Time on it?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, so we have a lot for both older folks, and we have a lot for the younger folks, too.
I want to ask you a particular question about the movie, the Hollywood thing.
Yes.
There was in one of the movies, one of the stars is Ruth Warwick.
Ooh, okay.
Oh, okay. And
tell me which one, because that name doesn't ring a bell with me.
Wow, I don't remember, because what I was trying to, and outside, you have the posters of the movie.
Absolutely, yes.
So one of them that you have that Ruth Warwick is in, and what I was kind of wondering, when they showed that, was the female that they showed in there, was that Ruth Warwick?
Well, gosh, you know, you've stumped me there, because the name Ruth Warwick does not ring a bell with me. So I'm afraid I can't help you. You'll have to come back, and we'll have to check it out together.
Well, Ruth Warwick, by the way, she was lately, or in the last whatever years,
yes.
She was on a soap opera. That's how everybody knows her. But she was known for being in that movie with the thing with the sled. Remember the thing that they called it the Rosebud.
Oh, you've stumped me. You've got to come back.
Okay, I'll come back. All right, let's go back to this again. So, there's the first you have this the one area where you're walking through and you're seeing like different like stables that have the years.
As you walk into the museum, first of all, you're hit with what it's like to actually come into a racetrack, and you can hear the race calls. You can hear a great race going on underneath the grandstand, and you pay your admission, but you don't actually pay your admission because you realize that, didn't you? We're free. I mean, this is one great outing that you and your kids can come to, and the admission is no admission. It's just without charge. And you can come in and you go visit the orientation theater. And there you really learn firsthand what harness racing is all about, right from the beginning, right through the exciting races that we have today throughout the country. And then from there you proceed into a 1913 stable. And that stable really leads you through how racing began, how it meandered through the 1800s, 1900s, until the current day. And that gives you a really good overview about what the sport is all about, where it's been, where it's gone, and where it is today. And
right.
Then you can go into another big gallery, and there you can see how the sport went to Kentucky, because it was very, very important in Kentucky, but it only was important there because of what happened in Orange County, which is where Goshen is located. Mm-hmm. Orange County was the place where harness racing began, and from there they exported their fine stock, mostly their stallions, to various parts of the country. Governor Leland Stanford had them out in California, and he was also a trotting man, and he bred the Orange County horses and had some really wonderful experiences and success with them. But then also a lot of the stallions went down for various times, maybe, you know, a season or two, or maybe permanently, down to Lexington, Kentucky. And it was there that many of our famous horses were bred and were foaled. And we have an exhibit in our Currier & Ives gallery at the present time that explains that. It explains where where the horses from standardbred horses from Kentucky came from. Then you can go upstairs, and there we have breeding and bloodlines, which explains where the horses, the standardbred, the trotting horses came from, and the famous farms. You can see the interiors of famous farms. You can see how an actual horse auction takes place. You can talk to a talking horse. Gosh, he has lots to tell you about things that you can see and what he does in his life. You can jump on a sulky, try it out, see how it fits the size. You can go to your harness racing in Hollywood, take a look at the first mobile starting gate, a 1935 model TD Ford. You can see what people do at racetracks. It's called Meet the People. You can see what an amateur race is like and who amateurs are in our sport. believe it or not, in the harness racing business, anybody can be part of the sport. It doesn't matter your gender, it doesn't matter your size, it doesn't matter your age. And we have a huge band of wonderful, wonderful amateur drivers who each weekend will lease or own their own horse and go to various racetracks and compete. They have a wonderful time. We even have one amateur who won our major race, a $1 million race at the Meadowlands in New Jersey, and he competed against professional drivers, Mal Burrows, and his wonderful horse, Malabar Man. You can see our Hall of Fame, very, very different to the Halls of Fame that you have, say, up in Cooperstown. Ours are little lifelike statuettes of the people.
Oh, yeah, that was very cute.
Did you like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I will tell you, during Hall of Fame Day, when we have our Hall of Famers visit, the fans can actually, they'll say, oh, look, there's so-and-so. Look at his little statuette. I mean, it's quite fun to see the enjoyment that people have with that.
You didn't meet Esther, did you, either?
Well, I didn't meet Esther, but I have a feeling I know who Esther is. She had a ride on our horse, didn't she?
Yes, she did. She insisted.
Now, did she tell you how much she enjoyed it?
Oh, yes, she absolutely. I have a photo of her riding the horse. She had a I thought she had a great time. I mean,
I hope she wants. Did she tell you she wanted to come back?
She told you. Yep. Well, I know it's not connected, but I want people to also know that there is a track there too.
Yes, there is. Yes, okay. We're very, very lucky because so many people will come to a museum or a sports museum especially and want to see the sport in action, and they don't have that opportunity. With us, we're very fortunate to have Goshen Historic Track, which is the oldest harness track in the country, 1838.
Wow.
And you can actually go out back and you can watch the standard bred horses of today working out. And it just gives people a really first-hand view of what the sport is all about. And you can walk around the stables. Nobody minds you taking a look around. And the trainers and the drivers that are out there are more than happy to talk to you about their very, very great love, which is harness racing.
Do they ever have actual races there, or just a training area?
No. They have racing. They have racing every Saturday in June, and then the July 4th weekend, which is this year, actually, Hall of Fame Day is July 4th. So it would be the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th. There is great racing at Historic Track, very nominal admission charges, and I invite everybody to come up. We're only 60 minutes from New York City. It's bucolic. It's country. This is a wonderful, wonderful area to visit. Beautiful restaurants in downtown Goshen.
Oh, sure.
Wonderful places to see and lots of things to do.
So, in other words, in terms of somebody coming there, I mean, the racing itself is basically just in June when there's actual racing.
It's pretty well every Saturday in June, and it's the July 4th weekend.
Okay.
Superb racing, July 4th weekend. The weekends in June, I believe that there is Youth Day, there is Veterans Day, all sorts of special days. I think the 6th, maybe the 13th, I'm just off the top of my head now, but every Saturday from the 6th through, you will be able to see some great racing, have lots of fun, bring a picnic. They have absolutely superb snacks under the grandstand. It's old world. It's step back in time. You want to step back in time, you come up to Goshen. You'll enjoy it. They have great sausage and pepper rolls, which are fabulous. It's just a step back in time.
So, in other words, to really do a really full day, just coming up there, coming to the museum, and going to a race would really...
No question about it. You'll be glad you did. It's worth the trip. And don't forget, the museum is free.
Right.
We have no admission charges because the United States Trotting Association subsidizes all admissions because we want people to get to know our great sport, the sport of harness racing.
Oh, okay. So actually, would be the way really to do it is the first, for anybody who doesn't know anything about harness racing at all, it would be best to like pop in the museum, get the get there early, go to the museum, and then go to the race.
Absolutely, that's a good plan. Absolutely, no question about it. Post time at Goshen Historic is 1 p.m. So, you know, if you came to us around, we open at 10. We're open 7 days a week, 10 to 5. And as I say, the track post time is 1 o'clock. So it's, and we are available at www.harnessmuseum.com, or you can give us a call at 845-294-6330. We're happy to answer any questions you may have about the sport of harness racing.
Okay. That's really great. Yes, I'll be back because I
very good. I do hope you and your friend will be back.
Yeah, and we will. So I think
good job.
I think she was absolutely thrilled to have
good job.
Have sat on that
on the sulky, right?
On the sulky, and she actually grabbed the reins too.
Good job, Everybody wants to grab the reins. That's the only way to go.
Yeah. Okay, I appreciate you calling in. And,
you're very welcome. It's lovely talking to you and to your listeners. And please come visit us in Goshen, New York. We're just 60 miles from New York City, and we have free admission. And we'd love to see you.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much,
Gail.
Yeah, great to speak to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, so... And don't forget, as I said before... all this information you can get in case you don't want to, do all the websites. You can always go to orangetourism.org, or if you think about it, it's Orange County, New York, and you can Google that, Orange County, New York tourism, and that'll get it to you as well. So, well, I'm gonna end off here, and so I'm going to continue speaking about some of the places in Orange County next week, and so I hope you'll tune in then. And me, I'm gonna go drink some more wine and get shikha. That's it. I'm sorry. That's a Jewish word for drunk. I mean, that just Anyway, one day I'll go into some of the more interesting Jewish expressions. I love them. They're so funny, the things that they sarcasm. So have a great day, evening, or wherever it is by you. And...